Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine. For the Sunday after Thanksgiving, November 25th, I'm your host, David McLaughlin, and joining me is each and every week, welcome Tim Shiflett.
Good evening, sir.
And welcome Catherine Smith.
Hello, everyone. Welcome from Atlanta.
Yes, got a big show this evening. Going to have Greg King come on at about 7:10 to talk about Florida politics, and there's always lots going on in Florida. With a state that big and that diverse, no doubt there's always news. And then in the second half hour, Don Weigel joins us of Better Georgia. Now, Don may have been on in the past to talk fundraising, but in the past year or so, he started a group called Better Georgia, and we talked about their polling they had done, and it was very useful to us on the show. And they have other initiatives. They've been involved in a lot of things. They've got national attention. And so Don's going to tell us all about that in the second half hour. But until then, we're going to talk about a Senate race in our home state of Georgia. Saxby Chambliss is up for re-election, and usually when somebody's won re-election a time or two, they're pretty much home free. And if you looked at general election, you might say, hey, Georgia's not quite there yet, particularly in an odd, not an odd year, but a non-presidential year to, you know, elect a Democrat, so Saxby Chambliss should sail through. Well, not so fast. The Tea Party has really gotten galvanized in moving against Saxby Chambliss, and it seems like even almost rank and file Republicans are just looking to get rid of Saxby Chambliss as well. Catherine, why are people so angry at Saxby Chambliss?
Well, most recently because he refuses to go along with the Grover Norquist no tax increase pledge. But I think, you know, the longer someone's in the Senate, the more times they vote and the more times they do something that might upset their constituents. And so as we look more closely at those things and have more information in our hands, I think people just express that dissatisfaction more openly. But I think the tax thing is a big part of it.
I think that's the latest thing. But I do think that there were things before that, if you will, that led to this. It seems kind of strange, Tim, that Saxby Chambliss is probably the more conservative of the two senators between him and Johnny Isaacson. But Johnny Isaacson is not as vilified by the Tea Party at this point, or it could just be coming next time he runs. Why is Saxby Chambliss, why is he more on the target list, if you will, than Johnny Isaacson?
Well, one thing, you see his face more. You see him a lot on the morning talk shows, you know, out of Washington on Sunday mornings. You don't see Johnny Isaacson much. Chambliss is being viewed more as a, quote, Washington insider, because of his participation, like in the Gang of Six and that sort of thing. Chambliss also is getting a rep as more of a deal maker with senators on the other side, which in this moment's Republican Party, you just don't want that to happen to you. All those things. And it's just put a great big bullseye on him, David. And I got to admit that I think there are a lot of Republicans in Georgia looking to move up that are just salivating, waiting on the 2014 election season to start, because I think he's going to have several opponents. And I think he's in a little bit of trouble, don't you?
Oh, I think I do. Now, Tim, it's kind of crazy. You said deal making. You think that would be somebody that's considered a statesman, if you will, or someone that understands how to get things done. I thought things like gridlock were bad words.
No.
And the Republicans didn't learn their lesson then.
No.
Seems like the American public said, you're too far to the right. You need to moderate. Maybe Saxby Chambliss is trying to do this, going against Grover Norquist's pledge, but he's going to get smacked down for it.
He's in Georgia. This state right now is dominated, you know, I think, by the most conservative elements of the party. The Tea Party folks don't play that partisanship stuff. Their idea of partisanship is you agree with them. And, you know, if Chambliss, what he's doing is good for a general election campaign, but there's just no way that he's going to escape without serious opposition. You know, one of the congressmen, I mean, one of the top-tier congressmen, if they smell blood in the water, they're going to come right at him. And watch Price. Watch him. See what he does. That one could come get him.
Well, let's get into names. Karen Handel's name was mentioned. You know, she got up from a point or two from winning the Republican nomination for governor, which some people would say is akin to winning the governorship. Tom Price, Lynn Westmoreland, who had looked at running for governor instead of Nathan Deal, people felt he backed off of that race because he may have been looking at U.S. Senate. They said Jack Kingston's looked at U.S. Senate for a while. Tom Graves, who's not as old as them, nor as experienced as some of the names I mentioned, people said he'll be a Tea Party favorite. If he doesn't run, State Senator Barry Loudermilk has people having a draft him booth. Now, that could be two people in a phone booth pushing that. But nevertheless, there's a lot of names out there. Catherine, of those names, which one do you think has the best shot at taking him out, or will more than one of those names come up?
Well, I think Karen Handel is sort of the, you know, is very popular among the Republicans in Georgia, but I can't see Georgia electing a woman senator right now. I mean, I can see the party putting her forward in a primary, but I'm not sure she could get elected. I think Jack Kingston has a lot of visibility. I think being from Savannah gives him an advantage over just like a metro Atlanta person. And he is very, I'm not a big fan of his. I know a lot of people like him, but he's very personable and very, I don't know how much he's beloved by the Tea Party people, but he is very personable and friendly, apparently. So I guess I would think of those names mentioned. I mean, how old is Tom Price? I don't know how old he is. I mean, Saxby Chambliss is going to be 70. So, I mean, we probably would like to get an earlier model or a later model right now, wouldn't we? They're going
to
be in there for a while.
Republicans wanting to hold on to the seat, I think Tom Graves would be the youngest of those candidates. Interesting you say that about Georgia and women. You know, Georgia has never really elected a female to an executive or Senate office since Rebecca Latimer, the first female senator, was appointed. So it's really been kind of a black mark on Georgia politics, both Democrat and Republican. And so it would be interesting to see if Karen Handel could break through that glass ceiling if she were to get the nomination. And, of course, we can talk about the other side of the coin another time. Who would the Democrats put up, not knowing what the landscape's going to look like? But right now we're going to move down south to vacation land in Florida and join Greg King. Welcome, Greg.
Hey, good evening, guys. How are you?
Yeah, good to have you back.
Oh, it's always a pleasure to be on. Thank you so much for having me on, Dave.
Yes, well, Greg, we got so many things to talk about in Florida. But first thing, Florida was probably the closest state in the election, but the president held Florida, and a lot of the different models said that the president would lose Florida. It would be, it would go just as quickly as North Carolina and Indiana, and it didn't. And it actually took a long time to calculate the votes, and we can get into some of that. But, Greg, how did the president and I guess you can also add to that Bill Nelson win the state of Florida?
Well, you know, I saw Bill Nelson as early on. You know, Connie Mack had a hard challenge. He's never, you know, he ran before, and you know, people have, you know, I was telling you before, he's a promoter for Hooters, so people don't have that same, you know, statesman view of him that they would have for Bill Nelson. You know, Bill Nelson is revered by Democrats and you know, doesn't have a lot of knocks against him as would, you know, Mack had gone through the divorce. You know, there was talk about him not living in his congressional district and all those great things. So he had a uphill climb. He was coming behind in money also. And as I said, also, there's almost a concession for it has been for so many years in Florida where, you know, they split the seats and that type of thing. You know, Marco Rubio, who was a much better candidate, you know, ran in the last cycle for Senate. So, you know, and that was the case. I don't think Connie Mack was that strong of a candidate. But regarding the president, you know, I think the Republicans outsmarted themselves with some of the voter suppression moves. And as it turned out, they thought that the Democrats wouldn't turn out again. And the turnout numbers are very similar. And I think it dissuaded some Republicans from showing up, especially in South Florida, because you're looking at the same numbers. The Democrats did come out, and they held strong. And I know from organizing before the campaign that there was a commitment. We did a pretty big a voter education event with our Al Sharpton. I helped organize that with Al Sharpton and a couple of our larger bishops and some elected officials, just as a voter educational event. And people came out. You know, people, you know, they understood. And it's it, too. I thought it was a bad move in any event. Because when you show your hand like that and say we're going to do some voter suppression things, and then they outsmarted themselves by making this long ballot, which was – and that was part of the reason for the delay in the count. You know, the ballot was, I think, in some places 10 pages long. So they stacked it with these constitutional amendments for the state of Florida, and it backfired on them because I think maybe two of them passed, two or three. So a lot of the things that they did to try to, you know, dissuade voters to discourage the vote kind of sort of ended up going back against them. So, and Obama, I will tell you, his campaign did some great, great organizational things in the last couple of weeks. I mean, they pushed right through, though. But I was really encouraged by some of the things that they did in the final month.
Yes. Well, you had kind of alluded to some voter suppression and some of the voting problems that Florida's had. So I'm going to pass it to Catherine Smith, who's going to ask more direct and pointed questions about that.
Hey, Greg, thanks a lot for being on tonight. We really appreciate
it. Pleasure.
Hope
my
you
pleasure.
Had a nice Thanksgiving. It's always yeah. nice to...
Tomorrow's my birthday, so
oh,
I'm excited.
Well, great.
Hey.
So it's a good week for Greg.
Yes.
I just wanted to talk a little bit more specifics about the voter suppression. I knew that long ballot was problematic, but didn't they also cut back on early voting in Florida?
They cut back on the number of days, but they didn't cut
mm-hmm.
back on the number of hours. And that's where you know people were thrown off. It's still the same amount of hours. It was from 7 to 7.
Oh,
they
okay.
Cut out
that
the Sunday.
Good.
Yeah. So, but and they cut out the Sunday before the election. So you had 2 days of silence instead of one as it had been. So I think that threw some people off. I mean, you still had the same number of hours. So that you know, I didn't even think the early voting was as big of a deal as the long ballot, because people don't care about the hours as much. Because all you want to do with voting, you know, with the early voting, is give people who work certain different schedules an opportunity to vote. That's it.
Yeah, and I think extending the hours, even if you shorten the days, is good. Because
right.
I think that, you know, here in Georgia they did that for the first time, too, where they had the ballots, the polls open later, but fewer
right.
days. And I thought that was good, though I'm a day of the vote voter. But
right. Well, you know, even with that long ballot, even during early voting, if they had and see, it's almost like a potato-potato thing. If they had extended the days, it still would have been the same situation. because you had that long ballot where it's taking people, you know, 30 minutes to vote in the booth.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, in the booth. So it was and you know what people don't realize, too, is and they say all the problems that we have with our ballots and that type of thing is, believe it or not, voting and the way we vote, even if you had a touch screen, it's sometimes one of the most complicated things a lot of people will do.
Oh, yeah.
You know, people, a lot of people aren't computer literate. You know, my daughters say sometimes I'm not, but, you know, that's a generational thing, and it's a cultural thing because, you know, coming from a lot of South Florida Floridians come from the Caribbean where, you know, they're less, you know, computer-based and, you know, more interpersonal and familial. So that's
what other kind of things were they doing? Were they doing some of their other nasty tricks where they're, you know, trying to get people to tell people they're supposed to vote on Wednesday and all that kind of stuff, or was that less?
That was less. You hear that fairly, but what you did hear, which was quite interesting, you got some people from, because the way we vote is a little different, and you got some people from the Caribbean who said they just saw the bubbles and filled them all in, so they did that on their own. But some people were telling us also, for some reasons, the ballots were flipping, or you only came up with one choice, and that's something that they researched, but it was so few and far between. You know, and interestingly, you know, we have bigger issues of just counting ballots. If we can just get them counted, I think we'll be all right. But
well,
you know,
it's going to take you a little while.
You know, I really think that they thought, you know, some of the suppression things that they did with the long ballot, with changing the hours, and that was a total distraction. And that's what I was telling people, you know, the hours are still the same, and that's what you want, the hours. It was a total distraction. You know, that in killing the registration, which I thought they thought would help them more. But those are the things that I thought they, you know, the Republicans felt would help carry them. But I think they backfired on them.
Yeah, well, I think those things backfired in other places too. And I think that we saw on election night a lot of Republicans were really shocked that all these things they thought were going to make a difference backfired on them.
Well,
so,
and the worst thing you can do to an underdog is to hit him early, because if he withstands your punches, you know, once we got through the voter suppression and educated people on, you know, what was going on, they're like, okay, well, if they want to do that, then we'll just turn out in greater numbers.
Yeah.
And that's what they did.
Well, thank you very much. I'm going to pass this over to Tim, right? I think he's got some questions for you, and then
hey,
probably
Tim.
Come back to me.
Okay.
Yeah, while we're on the presidential election, Greg, President Obama this year won Cuban Americans. Now, in the past, obviously that group has been reliably Republican. Why did that change this year?
Absolutely, strongly Republican. And I can't, you know, I will tell you that that's a very remarkable group politically. And I can't put my finger on it, Tim, and I've been trying to trace it. I will tell you this, that the Republicans, it's so funny in Florida. Florida's a little different in that on the state level, they run excellent campaigns, even for governor. But on the national level, they've just been telling off, even, you know, and we're largely Democratic anyway, but it was surprising to see that more, and not more substantially, but, you know, a lot of Cuban-Americans did vote for Obama. And I will tell you, though, also that a lot of that, or some of that had to do with health care, because, you know, we have an aging population also. So, you know, and a lot of our industry is tied to medical care. So, but I haven't been able to put my finger on that one. There have been a lot of articles about it, but that's a tricky one. I know for, you know, Obama had a great ground campaign again. You know, his campaign did great on the ground, whereas I didn't see a presence.
The only thing that I could figure about that, Greg, was, you know, when I was a kid, and I'm going to give away my age now, of course I remember the Cuban Missile Crisis, the
right.
Bay Pigs, and all of that. And that generation is either very old or gone now, as are a lot of their children, a lot older. But then this third generation of Cubans, like the grandchildren, the young people that, you know, the president appeals to, I was thinking maybe that vote was a generational thing.
A big part of it, and actually I was with a group of, I was working with one of our state, I was in out in West Dade, where it's largely Republican, and talking to a young Cuban American who was at a Republican gathering. Actually, his family is staunch Republicans, very politically active, hold elected office, and he was sitting there in front of him saying, "Hey, I voted for Obama." You know, I think the guy is bright, and so I will tell you in the especially on a national level, in the changing political environment, people are, because there's so much information, and Obama's camp gets it out there greatly. He has a strong technological presence. Because there's so much information, people who go out there and get it make those kind of decisions, and they break from the pack. It's not so much when interestingly enough, and it's happening in the Haitian community, even when, like, say you have a city in Haiti, a lot of people from that same city would move to the same area of Miami because of the familiarity. And then when it's election time, you know, one or two people who are usually the political leaders will go and say, okay, these are our people. But now with the internet and the young people now, and they're very technologically advanced, you know, they get the information for themselves, they make their own decisions, and they break away, and they decide what they think is best for them. So it's a lot better. And I like it. I say it's better because information. I love information. So,
okay.
So you're right. That has a big influence on it, too.
All right. Well, I'm going to do like Catherine and reserve the right maybe to ask another question down the road, but I'm going to throw it back to David.
Okay.
To do the subject changing, David.
Yes, well, Greg, obviously we like information, too. That's why we're having you on, to give us some. And let's get into another fella. Charlie Crist was not on the ballot probably for the first time in several cycles, but he still was a political force. He seems to be wanting to become a Democrat and make Democrats trust him, if you will. Is it working?
I've worked campaigns for a minute, and I knew at the time, and he, you know, his I met him years ago, and his presence wasn't even staunch conservative. He's been more populist to me. I mean, maybe he gets up to the podium and says one thing, but, and also I've worked with a lot of Democrats on the state level, and their opinion of him as a Republican governor was very, broader than a staunch, the conservative that he said he was. And it's so interesting because and he upset a lot of Republicans, and that's why he couldn't get the Senate nomination because of that. And so he knew he was more centrist. He played it off as being conservative, I guess, to get the votes. But and there's a it's so funny because we had a campaign in South Florida where I think a guy just ran to get his name out there for other purposes. You know, and now that Crist is, and actually he just picked up a big legal case. I don't know if it's just for the legal case, but he is going to, you know, every time, you know, they're already now have negative ads against him as a, and he's not even a candidate, and they're running ads against him. So, I think that's one where, you know, the Republicans are going to be mad with him switching, and the Democrats are going to be like, well, you know, just yesterday you were saying this. So I don't know how that's going to go. He has an easy target in Rick Scott. I don't think anybody likes Rick Scott too much. So, with that, Charlie Crist, you know, he does have the name recognition, a lot of name recognition. And Democrats don't dislike him. Never have, but I think the Republicans will pull out all stops to neutralize him.
I
think it's a good guy.
Yeah, well, I know Catherine's going to ask more about Rick Scott, but I'll ask about Democrats. If Democrats say, hey, Rick Scott is in trouble, we can beat him, why don't we go ahead and beat him with one of our own? Because I will tell you, I found more, a lot of times party switchers are more accepted by that other party if it's like, hey, we can't win it unless we have this guy, because this guy can, or this lady can get the middle.
I think Chris is going to be a liability.
Yeah, why are Democrats not willing to just say, hey, or why are they going to be willing to accept him and not just want their own guy?
I don't think, in the end, I don't think they do. I think he's going to be more of a liability because I think when you really get him out there and put him in front of especially independents, which Florida has a lot of, it's going to kind of sort of expose him. And there's a lot of negative stuff about him in any event. He was propped up by the Republican machinery. I think when he gets out there and is in the face of everybody, I think the Democrats are going to go with probably Alex Sink. who ran last time. I thought she should have won. There were some, you know, maybe some organizational issues. They didn't, you know, mobilize the vote enough. You know, you only had like 35-40% turnout. But I do think Democrats aren't going to go for the Christie. I think, you know, it's almost like, you know, we can use him while we can. But I don't think he makes a good candidate in the gubernatorial race.
Okay, good to know. Well, then I'm going to pass it to Catherine, who's going to talk more about the flip side of that, and Rick Scott.
Okay.
Catherine?
I'm sorry.
Okay.
Sorry
about Rick. You were going to ask about Rick Scott.
Yeah, I had my mute on. I'm sorry. I was talking. Nobody could hear me.
Right.
So Rick Scott, he's had very bad approval ratings in the past. Is that improving at all, or is he still pretty?
They've edged up. I think fewer people disapprove of him. He's edged up a little bit. I think he's at like 35-40%. Around 40% approval, and 10% really could care less. So he's in the poll that, you know, he's come out under Alex Sink in another race. But I will tell you that he has not, and especially, you know, one of the comments was that I read was that, you know, people appreciate him for sticking to his guns and not accepting Obamacare. Well, now he's more leaning towards accepting it now. You know, that was a political thing at the time. But I don't see him. You know, his thing was, I'm going to create jobs. I think it was 700,000 jobs, or some ridiculous number. That he's only cut jobs now. He's privatized. He's trying to privatize prisons. So I don't see it. I don't see his popularity changing. I don't see him. He doesn't have I can't remember the caricature that they give him. And it's not. I can't remember it, but it's hilarious. But he doesn't have a personality, really. So it's hard for him to change views. I mean, it is, you know, he looks, you know, no offense to the guy, and I think he's worked hard to get where he is, but he kind of sort of comes off as a serial killer to me. He just has that spookiness about him. So I don't
know. Yeah, well, that's not a very good personality for a governor.
Right. Yeah. It's weird.
Well, are there any people waiting in the wings for 2014? What do you think is going to happen?
They're talking about Alex Sink. I think Nan Rich, who is from South Florida, has put her name out there. She's fairly popular in Tallahassee, very effective as a Democrat, can be against a supermajority, has a lot of experience. So I think I think what it was, you know, with the Tea Party support, which I think will die down, that he had before, with his selling jobs, what people see aren't realized, I don't think he can turn it again. And then with his $80 million, which I don't think he'll mind putting back in the race, but I don't think it'll help him. I think Alex Sink can, you know, revitalize her machinery, and the party can, and really take him out, I hope.
Oh. That's great. I'm optimistic about that as well. Okay, I think it's back to Tim now.
Yeah, right, sir. I can't let a discussion of Florida get by without asking about this, because when I first heard the name Patrick Murphy last year, I got to admit to you that I was one of those that largely viewed him as a sacrificial lamb. I mean, he's 29 years old. Never run for political office before. He's facing a Tea Party darling. I mean, if somebody's carrying the banner at the head of the Tea Party army, it's got to be Congressman West. And he would have over $10 million, as it turns
out
he did, to spend. And I just thought he was a juggernaut that could not be beaten, even though the terrain was more favorable for the Democrats. And lo and behold, this kid wins. How in the world did that happen?
Well, you know, it's you live by the sword, you die by the sword. I think, first of all, that when you look at that, Alex Sink, who, you know, lost statewide but won that district, you knew there could be problems, especially with the turnout that you would be looking at and it, you know, the turnout will be regardless of the race. And I don't think I think Alan West is so polarizing. I don't think he changes a mind. So he would have to run for a district that leaned Republican, or that was, you know, that had a history of voting Republican. So that, I you know, you could see coming in that, but then, you know, there's another thing about organization and getting your name out there, and Patrick Murphy did a great job of that. You know, against $10 million, you have to say that Alan West's operation just shot itself in the foot. It kind of sort of played out everywhere except Palm Beach. In Palm Beach, they broke even, and I think if Alan West could have picked up anything, it would have been a different race, obviously, because it was so close, but he couldn't pick up anything in Palm Beach, which is, you know, has a large Democratic population, so they stuck to their guns and held off the other counties. So I think that's where it broke, but it's, you know, I like it when young guys come up and work hard, but, you know, looking at it before the race, and you said that he was running against all those things, you would have thought he didn't stand a great chance, but, you know, Alan West is just so polarizing, and then he moves into a new district that people have to get to know him again and all that great stuff. So it just, you know, spelled his doom.
Yeah, well, I got to let a little secret out of the bag here. Of all the races in America that night, all the way up to the presidential race, I've got to tell you, hearing that Alan West lost was my favorite. It was just my favorite. If I could have picked one race, they could say, okay, you can only win one. Which one will it be? I would have picked that one. You know, so
I'm sure
you've talked to a lot of people in a lot of states just like me. So
yeah, he put it in his mouth.
Oh, yeah.
Alan West put his foot in his mouth, and I think that he needs some humility, some political humility, and that will teach you. When a guy has a lot less money, a lot younger, a lot less experience, and kicks your butt.
Yeah. Well, I've learned the hard way that if losing does not teach you a little humility, then you're not capable of it. So
Exactly.
Anyway, you know, the presidential race and that race I just mentioned – and Nelson's race grabbed all the headlines, but looking down the ballot, now we know the Republicans were totally in charge of the whole process, in charge of redistricting, in fund control in Tallahassee, and yet on election night, lo and behold, in legislative races there, the Democrats picked up 5 seats in the House and 2 seats in the state Senate. The election victory in Florida was a complete victory, wasn't it? Top to bottom of the ballot.
It was, I think when you got to sort of temper it, because Republicans have super majorities here, so you temper it.
Uh-huh.
But it shows that the Democrats are getting back to organizing better, and that's what it comes down to. You know, Republicans had done it with their money. Now Democrats are doing it from a grassroots perspective. And I saw some things that I was really encouraged about with, and this was my knock against Democrats, and I think I mentioned in our last interview, is that they try to run things from the top up. You invest in the bottom and let the bottom run, you know, push your turnout, push your education, you know, the people who live there who are local. Don't, you know, you don't always bring in national people who are great organizers, you know, but you use your local tools. And that's what's been happening, and it's encouraging to see. So that's great. I think the and they did shoot themselves in the foot. And then you have my guy David Rivera who did some of the most inexplicable stuff you can imagine. so I mean, he was doomed. In his race, he stopped. You know, he was unable to raise money. Because of all of that, and he shot himself in the foot also. I mean, it's almost a hubris of thinking it's about you.
Happy note, I am going to send it back to David to close this out. David?
Okay.
Well, Greg, we're going to close out with a bang because we've got a big question to ask you about, and that's Marco Rubio running for president. Will he do it, and if he does it, is he the nominee, or is somebody else going to win the Republican nomination?
You know, it's interesting. I think I've heard Jeb Bush's name thrown about, and he has a better chance than Marco Rubio. I think if you look at Marco Rubio's support, which is very, very strong in, here in Florida, but it's you know, if you look at his core, it's, you know, it's really South Florida, and he is remarkable in any event because, you know, generally Central Florida runs a lot of these things. So coming out of South Florida, he's very popular, very well-spoken. I don't know if he can pull off the presidential. I think less. He'd be a great vice presidential candidate and then moving up maybe to the presidential. He doesn't have the experience, I can tell you that, that you would look for. But, you know, then again, Obama came through, you know, darling of the party type of thing. So brilliant guy, just like Obama. But, you know, there's been a lot of talk of Jeb Bush running, and he wouldn't run against Jeb Bush as, for the nomination. And then, too, what would stick him also is that, you know, I don't think you get an all-Florida ticket in any event. You know, I don't think the Republicans would go for, you know, your president and vice president from the same region. Or, heck, they live down the street from each other. So that wouldn't work out.
Yeah,
and
I
think
you...
Yeah, I think that's constitutionally unavailable.
You forfeit those electoral votes, and the Republicans couldn't start out by forfeiting Florida's electoral votes.
But,
yeah.
But you know, the thing is, Marco Rubio is very young, and I think he'd be, you know, better suited to win another senatorial race before he tries to do anything else. He has the time. There's no rush. And you know, a lot of times, too, with presidential elections, once you get out there, that's your shot. So I don't think he comes out this next election. I think it might be Jeb Bush and someone else, but not him.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, that's good analysis, and we'll continue to watch that as we have you on again. I'm sure some variation of that question will come up since that'll be a part of Florida politics. And actually, Marco Rubio, I know at least one of us, and I believe two of us, thought that he would be a better VP pick than Paul Ryan.
Much better.
Just because it might do a little better with Latinos, might have gotten a
much
few
better
votes in Florida, and a few votes could have been the difference in a state that close.
But,
so,
but you know,
he would have been a better pick.
We're all in politics, and you know that I think there was a forward-thinking thing from Rubio's camp that, you know, we don't want to waste it on this one. I think everybody knew it was going to come down to Obama probably winning, and so they didn't want to waste their shot with Marco Rubio as a VP in this one. I think they have a greater plan.
Maybe
so,
true, and that's why.
So with that, the Democrats have to bone up and get ready.
Yeah. Yeah, the field was probably would have been stronger than it was, but
right.
I think a lot of people actually saw that the president was going to be much more difficult to beat than
very strong.
Some
very
of the stalwarts
felt.
Yeah. Well, Greg, thanks again for coming on and talking Florida politics with us.
Oh, my pleasure, guys, and thank you, and I appreciate being on again.
Thanks,
Greg.
Happy
birthday, buddy.
Oh, yeah, happy birthday.
Yeah.
All right, Catherine. Thank you, David. Bye-bye.
Thanks again. Yeah, that was Greg King of Florida, always informing us on Florida politics, doing a good job again. Good to have Greg on. And I'm sure, like I said, we'll have him on in the future as more races get decided, because that is going to be one of the more exciting gubernatorial races at that. Well, before we have Donna Weigel call in, and he may call in at any minute, let's get back to that discussion about Saxby Chambliss. And we talked about, well, and, you know, as I say that, and that's actually perfect, because we can save that discussion for another time, we actually have Don Weigel of Better Georgia joining us. Welcome, Don.
Hey, how's it going?
Oh, good, and you?
Good, good. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, and I think you were listening live because you called in just perfectly as we finish with Greg. First thing, Don, since you're with Better Georgia, we know you've done some other things in the past, like work for the DPG. How did Better Georgia get started?
Better Georgia was started exactly a year ago this month by Brian Long, who became the executive director, Amy Morton, who became the chair, Governor Barnes was a part of it, and a lot of other notable progressives here in Georgia who just wanted to see the progressive political machine on the left really start hitting on more cylinders than we were.
Yes. So you get started, and you seem to hit a fever pitch just here in the last few months. Early on, what were some of the challenges and some of the things you had to get going?
Well, I think we've seen a lot of organizations pop up in Georgia since losing the majority back in, or the governor's mansion back in 2002. And the, you know, the DPG and the House and Senate caucuses and a number of other organizations, their influence on elections has really ebbed and flowed depending on the cycle. And I think what we're seeing nationally, too, is the political machine that, that drives elections is moving farther and farther away from the old, you know, party structure and into these new groups, that these nonprofit, you know, issue advocacy groups that are able to really be a lot more effective than your standard political party. A lot of these issues we have a whole bunch of support for until you stamp the word Democrat on it.
Yes, so you're having to fight that label issue in, I guess, parts of the South. Well, I got more questions because, as you know, when I was booking you, I'm fascinated by the polling you did, other initiatives you had going, but I have co-hosts on here, so I'm going to pass it along to Catherine and Tim and then come back to me and we'll see what else is left. Catherine, questions for Don about Better Georgia.
Hey, Don, how you doing?
Good. How are you, Catherine?
Good. I wanted to ask you about this recent attention that you that Better Georgia has gotten around the mind control meeting and how all that sort of how you managed to leverage that to some national attention and you know, even my friends in Michigan are asking me about it. So obviously, and I think that, that Better Georgia was a big part of that. So how did that all happen, or was it sort of a surprise to you guys as well?
No, this was actually really a great example of what Better Georgia does and will continue to do. We, since really starting the organization, obviously had our sights set on, you know, Tea Party favorite Majority Leader Chip Rogers. And we're looking for the right opportunity, you know, to call attention to some of his rather bizarre behavior. And we were notified of this meeting, and we sent a volunteer down to videotape it. He got about an hour's worth of footage of then-Majority Leader Chip Rogers hosting a meeting for this gentleman named Field Searcy, who is so extreme he was even kicked out of the Georgia Tea Party back in April, talking about Agenda 21. And for those that don't know, I'll be real brief here. The Agenda 21 is a conspiracy theory, you know, pushed by the right wing that Barack Obama, along with the United Nations and the Georgia Chamber of Commerce, is using Cold War era mind control techniques to move people from the suburbs back into the cities so that he can wage a war on the suburbs and take away everybody's land. It's pretty bizarre, really very far out there. And what's not surprising at all is this is not the first meeting that the topic of Agenda 21 has been down at the Capitol. It's just the first one that Better Georgia heard about. So we got somebody down there. We got an hour of it, and we had been sitting on that video for about a month, and we were waiting for just the right time to use it. And what we did in that time was built a whole plan. You know, I've done a lot of campaigns and worked for a lot of various political parties, state and local, and every boss I've ever had has asked me to create for them a viral video. And what I think they fail to understand is you can't create a viral video. What you can do is create a video, and if you actually execute against a plan, push it out there enough that it gets spread. Until this video, for example, we're pretty proud to tell you that it has now gotten over 1 million views and has been covered by Rachel Maddow, and we've even got David Letterman weighing in. But that only happened because we had a very strategic plan for how we were going to push this out with our partners on the left and working with both local and national media to get the story out there.
Well, you did great, and thank you, because it was
it's been a great
and it ended up having Chip Rogers resign, right?
that he did withdraw from his race to be the majority leader of the Georgia Senate, which is a huge victory for those
right.
of us who believe, you know, common sense and reason should rule the day.
And we don't know that that's the reason, but I think there's enough evidence.
No, certainly, you know, we shouldn't take all the credit. There were a lot of factors leading up to his decision not to go for this position again, but certainly it didn't help that you had the national media weighing in on this race. And once again, Georgia was embarrassed. And I think the people of Georgia are really getting tired of being embarrassed on the national level of our elected officials, while at the same time these same elected officials are failing to address the most important issues that we're facing.
Exactly. Okay, well, thank you, Don. I'm going to pass this over to Tim now.
All right, thanks, Catherine.
And good evening, Don. How are you, sir?
Good, Tim. Good to hear from you.
Listen, I was wondering, my assessment of election night, what happened in Georgia, and your assessment may not be exactly the same. I don't know. What was your assessment of election night in Georgia?
Just a couple weeks ago, it was difficult. It was another big hit for the left, certainly in Georgia. We now have the House and Senate with effective Republican supermajorities, and you know, we're waiting on a Senate seat that only has Republicans vying for it to officially claim that Republicans in the Senate have a supermajority. And in the House, the Republicans have a functional supermajority, which is Democrats did not meet that critical threshold of holding 61 seats. And since we failed to meet that threshold, the Republicans can now pass any piece of legislation they want without gaining a single Democratic vote. They will have to go to independent Rusty Kidd out of Milledgeville, but he already votes with them over 90% of the time. So whether he actually switches or not, as I hear he's rumored to be, at least considering, it really doesn't matter. Democrats are now completely unable to affect legislation down at the Capitol.
Mm-hmm. And so where does that leave the party going forward legislatively? I mean, what is the party to do to mount any kind of a challenge? What are they to do?
It's pretty simple, actually. What we need to do is basically exactly what we did for Chip Rogers just a couple weeks ago, what we did to a handful of Republicans during the previous legislative session when they were working on the drug testing bill for welfare recipients. We need to continue to call them out because they are wrong on the issues. Georgia is not a red state. We have what I call progressive performance anxiety, which is when we do these polls, we find majority support for a lot of progressive issues. A majority of Georgians want to see an increase of taxes on people making over $250,000. 57% of Georgians want that. 53% want increased taxes on corporations making more than $5 million. And 55% of the state wants increased taxes on both of them. 48% over 36%, so a 12-point spread, want stronger environmental laws. Even abortion, and this is something that's incredibly surprising to people when we talk about, that 52% of Georgians believe that abortion should be a choice between the woman, her family, her God, and her doctor, and that the legislative process should have little involvement in it. Only 30% want it restricted to cases of rape, incest, or when it threatens the life of the mother, and only 6% of Georgians want to see an outright total ban on abortion. While at the same time that only 6% of Georgia wants to see this thing, it's the number one issue that we hear getting talked about getting passed by the Republican supermajorities next session. Is they want to pass this personhood amendment, which only 6% of the Georgia population actually supports. And I could go on and on. A majority of Georgians believe in greater rights for gay and lesbian couples, more funding for public education. Virtually everyone is upset over these continued cuts to public education. Right down the line, these are progressive issues that we can be winning on, but we fail to because we don't have a machine to actually get our message out.
Mm-hmm. Now, you talked about our setbacks on election night, and I certainly agree with you. But right in the middle of all of that, and we talked about this at length last week as well, and we wanted to get your opinion on it, there's Congressman Barrow, target number one for national Republicans as far as taking over a House seat. The last white Democratic congressman in the Deep South, his district had been totally redrawn so that it was almost unrecognizable and supposedly deep red. And lo and behold, on election night, he not only wins, but wins fairly comfortably. How did he manage to do that?
By doing what he has always done, which is doing a great job of actually representing his district's views and concerns. And while you saw the Lee Anderson campaign, I mean, I think we can all agree that Lee Anderson was not the strongest candidate that the Republicans could have put forward. But I would argue that Barrow would have beaten an even stronger candidate because he's able to make that connection, because he ran a 21st century campaign, because he raised the money that he needed to. He got his message out, and he got it out more effectively than his opponent. And he was being straightforward and honest the whole time. And I really do believe that 2012 is the last year in Georgia that we are going to see the kind of Democratic losses, that we have. From here on out, we are going to continue to pick up seats, because what it's been for the last few years is a discussion between the right and the far right. And I think Georgians, by and large, are getting sick of it. Our own polling reflects this as well. We track with every poll whether people consider Georgia to be on the right track or wrong track. Going back to March of this year, only 31% of Georgians believe that the state of Georgia is moving in the right direction. Fast forward to August, that number had even dropped to 27% of Georgians believe that we are moving in the right direction. So we are starting to see a backlash of the policies that the Georgia Republicans and conservatives have pushed. They own this. You know, they have been in near total control since 2002 and 2004, and certainly ever since then. And now that they have these effective supermajorities in the legislature, they really have to own every piece of Georgia. And Georgia right now is looking a lot worse than it did a decade ago or even two decades ago. We are at the top of every bad list and the bottom of every good list that comes out. And we are really getting sick of it.
All right. And on that note, I'm going to throw it back to David. David?
Well, and still plenty to cover. Don, we talked about the polling y'all did, and I remember seeing the first one. And it showed a very positive picture for the president in Georgia, that he would kind of get roughly his 2008 numbers. And I sent that poll around to some places. I won't talk about the places I sent it around, and everybody kind of scoffed at it. But
that's right.
Lo and behold, on Election Day, and actually that was your first one, I think you followed up with at least one more since the time I'd sent it around. And your numbers weren't too far off at all. How did y'all end up getting such an accurate poll, and why do you think that it wasn't received any better than it was, and do you think that'll change going forward for Better Georgia's polling?
I do think that, I mean, I would hope that moving forward people would judge all pollsters running polls in Georgia by their accuracy more than anything else, and Better Georgia has conducted 4 statewide polls in 2012 alone, and you're right, we did pretty much nail it, especially in our final poll leading up to the election. But throughout the campaign, we had Obama at the lowest point at 44 and at the highest at 46, and our poll immediately before Election Day had him at 46. On average, we had Obama garnering about 45.25% of the vote, and he actually got 45.51. So only off by a half a percent there by our polling, and we had Mitt Romney right there at 52, and he got 53. So we were right on, because we are looking at the demographic in Georgia, how they are shifting, and modeling for them appropriately. If you look at these polls, there is, you know, you see guys like Insider Advantage, right, putting out, having Obama at 35%. That is absurd. Any Democrat walking into the election has a base of about 43% here in Georgia. And any point above that is based, you know, more on the performance of the candidate and the campaign. The only, you know, everybody remembers we did 47% back in 2008, and that was with a lot of, you know, really millions of dollars spent by the Obama campaign here in Georgia. And even when they pulled out, they did leave a lot of staffers behind who really still executed a lot of the GOTV program, though, you know, massively underfunded, obviously. But like I was saying, you know, Georgia is simply not a red state. What we have is a lack of a political machine to really move those numbers. Georgia Republicans were not wild about Mitt Romney. We had him in the mid-40s all throughout the campaign, and it wasn't until in our polling, the last one at the end of October, that he finally broke 50%. And what that was is the sort of conventional wisdom shift of those folks in the middle and the Republican Party being able to get their voters out versus the Democratic Party not being able to. I mean, for the first time in as long as I can remember, the Georgia Democratic Party did not even run a coordinated campaign to turn out the base Democratic vote, and certainly not one that was funded with multi-millions of dollars like it was even in 2008. The state party spent about $4 million on GOTV efforts. And that we're seeing nationally. We're seeing it all over the country, and especially in those states like Colorado, Wisconsin, Michigan, where we've seen the progressive movement really expand and grow powerful and move the state in the right, move those states in the right direction. It's because we have moved away from the old party system into a new, much more dynamic and simply more effective method of delivering our message.
Yes. Well, Don, I've got good news and bad news, and I always like taking bad news and turning to good news. We've talked about so many good things with you that we've run out of time, and that means we don't get to get into any of the initiatives that Better Georgia's has moving forward. But the good news is that means we've got to have you on sooner than later if you're willing.
Absolutely. You know, we're going to be doing one more statewide poll leading up to the legislative session, and I'd love to come back on and talk about that. And in the meantime, anybody who's listening who would like to help support Better Georgia or even just give us some advice, some issues that you get, that you all want to see pulled on, just go to bettergeorgia.com.
Oh, yeah, bettergeorgia.com, find out about it. And, Don, that sounds great. When that poll's fixing to drop or just has dropped, you let us know. We'll have you on a kudzu vine on a Sunday, right? Near there, and then we'll definitely ask more about initiatives moving forward.
I sure will. Thanks so much for having me, David.
And yeah, thanks again.
Thank you, sir.
Yes, great show tonight, guys. Greg King, just informing us of Florida politics. Don Weigel of Better Georgia just now. Just so much to say. We didn't even get to cover it all. That's how good he was. And then we talked a little bit about Saxby-Chambliss race, which we didn't even get that discussion finished, so that means we can hold that over till next week. And next week we're already starting to line up guests, but we'll be back on the kudzu vine. Till then, everybody.
Good night, guys.
Good night, guys. Thank you.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.